Hello and welcome to the 33rd episode of the Right Dishonourable podcast. Unfortunately, Jazza is away in India this week, so I'm joined this time round by John. John, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello, it's John here from the Right Dishonourable. Every now and again I post stuff. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, you haven't actually been on the podcast since the New Year's debacle, since, have you?
Not since the New Year.
Okay, and if you don't know what that is, you should probably go back and listen to it again. But yeah, I'm, as per usual, Jimmy, and this week we are covering three topics on social affairs, current events and politics and all that fun stuff. What we're going to be looking into this week, first up, is the UN panel's, I don't want to say ruling, but I'm going to say opinion on the Julian Assange case. Julian Assange is, of course, the founder and main man in WikiLeaks, who is currently holed up in an Ecuadorian embassy in Kensington in London, and has been for some years. And this week, the UN said that the situation amounted to arbitrary detention. And we're kind of going to be discussing what we think of that opinion, and just what's going on around the case more generally, because it isn't something that we've gone into a huge amount of detail on the Right Dishonourable before. Second up, John, what are we going to be covering?
Second up, we are going to be talking about Britain's potential Brexit of the EU, and the fact that this week there was a new sort of tentative deal struck. Some sort of negotiations have been supposedly finalised. They need to clear the European Council, but essentially we have our offer now of what a reformed, quote-unquote, Britain staying in the EU will look like when we come to vote on this. I believe that the sort of tentative date is June 23rd, and there's a lot of sort of, you know, debacle over whether or not Cameron has really got anything. So I suppose we'll be summing up the merits or not of what he managed to negotiate.
Indeed. And to finish up, we have a slightly odd topic for you. Don't laugh, come on.
It is just so stupid,
though. Okay, so people in the UK will know that I think it was sometime last year, the main presenter of Top Gear, Jeremy Clarkson, punched a producer in the face, which eventually ended up to him leaving the show, or being fired from the show, I should say.
Isn't it great that we can say that without fear of libel? Because he's actually just admitted to it.
Well, to be honest, like, his contract wasn't renewed, so I suppose from a very technical perspective that isn't firing, but from a perspective that any actual English-speaking human being would understand, that is a firing.
It's also just, like, the fact that we can say Jeremy Clarkson punched a guy is just...
Oh, yeah, I mean, there is also that.
It's just brilliant.
I mean, not for the first time as well, but more recently, the new presenters of Top Gear have been announced. Chris Evans is a BBC DJ that we've known about for some time, would be heading up the presentation, but... John, who's the stranger co-host that the BBC have just announced?
Oh, it's that guy that everybody knows because he's really hot at the moment, Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc is in Joey from Friends,
yeah,
right?
Joey from Friends.
And also Matt LeBlanc, who also plays Matt LeBlanc in Episodes, which is mildly funny. But we're going to be
funny, but mostly watched by Radio 4 people, apparently.
Apparently. Okay, I can believe that. But those are the three topics that we're going to be discussing, and now I'm going to play some music before we get to the other side and cover the case of Julian Assange.
Okay, so this week, the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention basically sat down and had a discussion. I mean, they've been having a discussion for a little while about Julian Assange, and it was meant to be 4 out of 5, but technically one of the people in the working group felt that she couldn't deliver a verdict because she is an Australian. So it ended up being 3 out of 4 people said that Julian Assange had been arbitrarily detained by the UK, Swedish, and European governances.
Is that the reason she said she didn't feel able to deliver a verdict?
I definitely read somewhere that she said she couldn't deliver a verdict because of sort of national conflict of interest, essentially.
Okay.
So yeah, there's only one dissenter. They actually have gone as far as to say that they think he should be entitled to compensation for arbitrary detention.
You mean the three that voted that it was arbitrary detention
Yes,
have said
yes,
that?
yes. Yep. Those three have said that he should be offered some form of compensation because he's been held in arbitrary detention for so many years. And they've said that he should be allowed to sort of walk free, and because obviously the EU have already said that he should be able to go free essentially within EU states. So they've said that he should be able to leave and go wherever he wants, essentially, and that he
So
should have.
for those who don't know, the situation around Assange is that he's in the Ecuadorian embassy because he essentially tried to escape arrest. In Sweden there are a couple of accusations but no charges, for reasons we'll go into later, about him having sexually assaulted one woman, or unlawfully coerced her as well. There's a couple of accusations that would translate into different charges, and then for another woman, there's an ongoing rape allegation. And the Swedes applied for a European arrest warrant in Britain, which was, after a very long period of legal wrangling, was accepted by a British judge. At which point, Julian Assange decided to seek asylum with Ecuador, and then fled into the embassy in Kensington that we mentioned earlier, which legally speaking is Ecuadorian territory, which means that the British police can't go in there and arrest him and then extradite him.
Yeah, I mean there are some complications around this case. So certain charges have been dropped because the statute of limitations has expired. The rape,
So it's the sexual assault charges that have been dropped because the statute of limitations, which is the period after which a crime has been committed, during which you can still make a charge, I guess, or file a charge, or whatever the term is.
Yeah, and see, this is it's a bit weird because obviously we think of charges slightly differently, apparently, to how they do. They apparently in Sweden will not formally charge somebody until they've had the chance to interview them, which is where this all comes from, this controversy over the fact that he hasn't been charged. One of the very weird things is I forget the exact terminology, but essentially he's. There's an arrest warrant for something called lesser degree rape.
Okay.
Now that's I mean I struggle to get my head around that what that could possibly mean. It all sounds a bit dodgy though because obviously from his point of view, his big argument about why he shouldn't go back to Sweden is he's worried about being extradited to the US, and that's what his lawyers have said as well, over things that WikiLeaks have published on the internet. And it's not a far leap to sort of consider that this would be possible, or even that he'd be extradited from the UK potentially.
See, but that you're right that that is his argument. But from my point of view, I think he'd be far more likely to be extradited from Britain than he would from Sweden. Because first thing is, Britain has a special extradition treaty set up with the US, which is very generous to them, not generous at all to us. It's a very much a one-way relationship in that sense. And Sweden doesn't have a similar treaty, as far as I'm aware. And is just, I think, just generally is more concerned about, the idea of sending somebody over to the US for them to be tortured, even though in Britain the Home Secretary, Theresa May, or the current Home Secretary, has vetoed certain extraditions, such as the one of Gary McKinnon, who was a British computer programmer slash hacker who was, wanted by the US authorities for attacking something I can't remember, some sort of the IT of a big American corporate, I think. But yeah, I don't buy that argument from a real politic kind of view. I can't really see the Swedes doing that, especially now that such a fuss has been kicked up over that being a possibility, I guess. But you seem to find that kind of realistic.
Well, I mean, the thing is that there are just some very weird details in this case. Supposedly, if you read up on the timeline of this, some women went to the police, and this all kicked off allegedly over them wanting Assange to get an STI test.
Yeah, that is true.
And then the police sort of said, well, no, we can't just question or arrest somebody over an STI test. You'd have to get a proper prosecution. And that's where this thing about lesser degree rape and molestation has come around. And I, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the guy is innocent of any of these crimes. For all I know, he's done some terrible things to these poor women. It's just, you know, when you throw in the fact that the US want him as well, and how long this has taken, and the fact as well that he's offered to let the Swedish authorities come to the UK to interview him.
That's not entirely true. I mean, he said,
I mean, it took a long time, but he has offered now, hasn't he?
Not really. I mean, he has said, come and interview me in Britain or in the Ecuadorian embassy, which, as I said, legally speaking, is Ecuador, which usually doesn't really happen. Is kind of a breach of protocol. You're supposed to be interviewed for Swedish crimes on Swedish soil. But they did actually broker a deal, or seemingly broker a deal, where a Swedish lawyer or a member of the Swedish public prosecution service came over with the intention of interviewing him, and then they got to the Ecuadorian embassy and they were not allowed entry. And Assange's track record with this is he's a duplicitous, you know, lying arsehole. Basically, it's very hard to trust very much of what he says, because, you know, that's just the sort of character he is. One example of this is that this week the news came out that Julian Assange was willing to give himself up for arrest if the UN panel was going to rule or give its opinion against him as opposed to in his favour. And it very quickly transpired that he was obviously already aware that the UN panel was going to give its opinion in his favour. And this is just a classic publicity stunt that Assange pulls all the time. You know, he's not a reliable narrator, I guess you could say. It's just very difficult to trust him with anything.
I didn't know some of those details. Coming back to the central headline of this week, though, do you think he's been arbitrarily detained? Because there have been some, I mean, I read what I, in my opinion, wasn't as convincing a counter narrative in the Guardian, but you said you read a very good one in the Financial Times or something.
Why don't you run me through the view of the Guardian editorial that you read?
I mean, the Guardian one, I can't find the exact one that I read, but it essentially said that he's detained himself through choice, and therefore, you know, this whole idea that he's been detained doesn't really work, because he's been in residences, essentially, because the Ecuadorian embassy is sort of a residence. Mm. It's not a detention centre. And therefore, this fundamental misunderstanding meant that the UN didn't really know what they were doing. I kind of thought that was just a bit of a tenuous argument.
Why do you feel that's a tenuous argument?
I know that I've just done a sort of reductive summing up, but, I mean, essentially, although he has been detained in favourable conditions compared to other people whom arbitrarily detained could be sort of applied to, the guy has still sort of lost years of his life, obviously for real fear of something. Like, I know, obviously, you just said about he's very good at being duplicitous and exploiting opportunities. But would you really stay in an embassy for so many years if you weren't genuinely worried about what... And I don't think he's worried about going through a court case in Sweden, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that he's paranoid. Like, that's very much... I've watched documentaries on him, I've sort of read a fair amount about him, and he does come off as quite a paranoid character.
Yeah, but, like, there's nothing that makes me believe that this is literally just all over what's happened in Sweden. Because apart from anything else... And, you know, we can argue about the merits of the law all day, but apart from anything else, he's probably got access to a good enough legal team to get him off whatever, you know, charges they could bring against him.
Yeah, I think most people would agree that. I mean, the FT editorial was very much gave the same opinion as the Guardian one, by the sounds of things. And the reason I find it... the reason I have a problem with your argument is that he's not been detained. He's resisting arrest. I mean, if you believe that he's been arbitrarily detained... You'd have to say that a crook who was hiding out in a warehouse somewhere where the police were not aware of where he was. If a crook hid out somewhere just in a building, didn't move around for 5 years, you'd have to say they were being arbitrarily detained, which is obviously absurd. Julian Assange is free to leave the Ecuadorian embassy at any time that he wants, but he will be arrested because he's wanted for a crime he's wanted for questioning over an alleged crime in Sweden. And so, you know, none of us, if we behaved the way he behaved, nobody would say anyone was arbitrarily detaining us.
See, the place that I sort of come to perhaps a disagreement with it is the fact that he had that chronic respiratory illness not all that long ago, and we wouldn't let him go to the hospital without fear of being arrested. Well,
it's the same thing, you know. If you want access to all the public services that anyone else has access to, you cannot do that and yet still expect to avoid arrest.
I mean, you can argue though that that's actually worse than what you would get if you were being detained, because if you're in detention, you still get access to medical care.
Facilities.
And he was deprived of medical.
Yeah, but no, he's depriving himself of medical care. No one else is depriving him of it.
I'm not sure it would have been. I know that it would have been a gesture, and I to be fair, I don't know the legal basis of whether it would even have been possible. But I kind of think it was wrong to not at least, I don't know, send in some NHS nurses or something.
Why? If this man wants access to our medical care system, he can have it. But you know, he has to also accept the responsibilities that go along with that. One of which is being liable to a European arrest warrant, which he is.
It does sort of fly in the face of human rights, though. The idea that, to be fair,
what about the human rights of the woman that have made the allegations? You know, the right to have somebody questioned, and to have their allegations taken seriously. The rights which he is denying them effectively by avoiding arrest.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a complicated case, isn't it? Because
I don't think it is complicated. I think it's very, very simple. Assange is in the wrong.
Oh, what, you think he's guilty?
No, I don't think he's. I don't know if he's guilty or not. The only people who know whether he's guilty.
Oh, you think he's wrong to deprive them of the right to?
Yeah, obviously. You
know. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you in principle. I understand to a degree why, because, you know, it's like Edward Snowden, that members of the Defense Department in the US have very clearly said they'd like to see him killed. And I would imagine that they've said similar things about Assange.
Quite possibly, you know.
And if the thing is, it's impossible to put yourself in a headspace where we don't know what's gone on in Sweden. For all we know, he's guilty, and a court case would bring that to light, etc. And I think anybody should stand trial for that kind of stuff. I'm not convinced he or Snowden or any sort of whistleblowers or leakers should, you know, or sources should stand trial for some of the stuff that they expose, because I think it's hard
that's a separate issue. It's not the same issue.
No, but I mean, this is the problem, is that it's kind of bound up, because although
the problem is that he's hid behind his status as a whistleblower, or really not so much a whistleblower as somebody who dumps large amounts of information indiscriminately on the internet, and he's used that to avoid facing justice or facing the judicial process at least.
In his defense, though, he hasn't had anybody sort of definitively say you will not be extradited by anybody upon
But that's a matter of legal process. The US have not charged him of any crime, nor have they requested his extradition. It just simply is not within the legal process, and it's not within the powers of the Swedish or British law enforcement services to actually be able to say we won't extradite you before an extradition request has even been made.
Well, yeah, but this is the whole thing, isn't it? The idea that the extradition request would be made upon his detention.
The US had a very long period of time in which they could have made an extradition request. Why they didn't during that time, I don't know.
I think in the hope that he would eventually come back out, because as I said, it makes sense to me.
Well, no, because there was a good 18-month period between when he was first arrested in Britain in connection with the alleged crimes in Sweden to when he went into the Ecuadorian embassy after the judge agreed that he would be extradited under European law. And
that you could argue away under case building, couldn't you? Because they obviously want to have quite a solid case for its extradition.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that. But as I said, I'm not particularly convinced that the Swedes would extradite him.
Yeah. I don't know. You don't think they would?
I think, well, there's obviously a chance, and I'm not, you know, being not intimately familiar with the Swedish extradition process, then I couldn't really say for sure. But if there was a significant chance of him being tortured by the American authorities, I find it very hard to believe the Swedes would countenance that.
I mean, I agree with you in principle that he's deprived these women of his day in court, and I don't agree with that because, as I said, for all we know, he's guilty of those crimes. The only thing that I sort of, you know, sympathise to a degree with is this, you know, very murky idea of whether or not he would be extradited to the US, where, I mean, let's face it, he could face some form of, maybe not the death penalty because there'd be too much of an outcry over that, but he could quite easily, I'm sure, face life imprisonment for some of the things that WikiLeaks are responsible for.
Yeah, that is quite possibly true. But you know, again, he was aware of the risks when he made the decision to actually leak that sort of information. Nobody is under any illusions as to how the American police state operates at this stage.
Is that a sufficient reason, though, to be in fear of them and not do anything? I mean, because I'm not all that, you know, Edward Snowden's leaks, I think, were very useful to the world. Mm. I don't know an awful lot about WikiLeaks leaks, but as my understanding is actually they just sort of damaged a lot of diplomatic relations.
So there was actually, there's a pretty good documentary that used to be on Netflix. I can try and dig out the name for the show notes. But basically the... If you watch that documentary, the Guardian journalists that he worked with, one of whom is a guy called Nick Davis, who was the guy who broke the phone hacking scandal in the UK, basically says that Julian Assange claimed to have edited down the files, to actually have reviewed all the files that were passed to him by Chelsea Manning at the time, Bradley Manning, and reviewed them before he released them onto the internet. The reality of it is that he just dumped them. And this was full of military intelligence, some of which connected to... kind of insiders and people in Afghanistan, say, who were passing information to the Western military authorities. And this potentially put them, and I think it actually did put some of them, in a great deal of danger of being killed. Mm. Irrespective of how you view the way the Americans have conducted themselves in the Middle East and further afield,
he shouldn't have endangered innocent lives.
Yeah, he shouldn't have done that. And the Snowden thing is a very good counterpoint, because Snowden worked with Glenn Greenwald to only release information that wouldn't put people at risk. There has been criticism from the American secret services that happened anyway, but at least there was some sort of editorial process to minimise the risk of that happening, you know, irrespective of whether they achieved it fully or not. Julian Assange was just irresponsible. You can protest things, and you can aim to actually counter things and disrupt things that you don't like, but you should do that in a, you know, controlled way. And I think the general tone of Assange's behaviour just throughout his life has been that he's more of a publicity merchant than he is somebody who's principled and actually wants to reform things for the sake of making things better.
I can't really argue with a lot of that. I mean, I wouldn't personally cast aspersions on his character, but I agree with your points about the difference between him and Snowden in terms of the publishing. I think that's a very well-made point.
Mm. Well, I think that's probably... I think we probably covered this in about as much depth as we need to, unless you've anything else to...
No.
Okay, so obviously, if you've got your own thoughts on this, do the usual things. Tweet us at RightDishonor, at JDE Nichols, which is my Twitter account, or at DonkeyOK, which I assume is still your account, John.
Still mine.
Or you can follow up with us on rightdishonorable.com, and we will see you in the next segment. This week, David Cameron returned to Britain with a potential deal, or a potential renegotiation of Britain's relationship with the EU. So the reforms that he had on the table revolved around sort of affecting the flow of migration into the country, a clause on not supporting ever closer union within the European Union, and also some other things that I've now forgotten. John, what else did he come back with?
I mean, this is the problem. He didn't come back with an awful lot, did he? He's come back with we've got this veto which is unusable because 15 other countries would have to buy into it. So essentially, it'd have to be a red card mechanism.
So the red card mechanism is about stopping benefits to migrants that come in from the EU, and to actually pass it, they need a 55% support from other members of the EU, which in practice, given that this veto would happen after a negotiation had taken place with all the various heads of states and leaders of the various EU member states, would make it very, very unlikely that it would ever be
Yeah,
used.
exactly, because said plan would surely have already been voted down if you can get 15 countries behind this red card. There's some there's some sort of provisions to allow certain bits of European legislation. What else is there? There's a new sort of legal precedent or something that's going to be committed to, where this idea of sort of ever closer union, we won't be part of that. We'll be recognised as, I quote, not committed to further political integration.
Yeah, so the ever closer union thing was from a treaty. I want to say Lisbon, but I'm not 100% sure at this point. But or actually, it might go further back. It might actually be from the Treaty of Rome, which is one of the original founding documents of the European Economic Community, as was. But it kind of lays out this sense that has always been within the EU debate, that eventually we're going to form some sort of United States of Europe, or the integration is going to become so close that that's effectively what we're going to be anyway. I think the way the press reacted to all these negotiations said basically that they weren't very substantial, which I think is indisputable, really. I read some people, I know the Economist and the FT, which I think count among the most pro-European of the sort of British papers, definitely tried to spin it as positively as possible. But the rest of them, the Telegraph, the Mail, the Times, probably not so much the Guardian, but all said that these negotiations weren't very substantial. I think even the Guardian came out with a report which said that the reforms were quite flimsy. John, what do you make of the renegotiation? Has it actually changed your opinion about the European debate one way or the other?
I mean, I read the Economist this week, which, as you said, is pretty sort of pro staying in Europe, and they're quite painful articles to read from the point of view of it came across as unusually bad journalism for the Economist, because they were essentially admitting that, these negotiations had led to nothing whilst saying that they were good enough.
Yeah, I mean, they said that the reforms were symbolic,
Yeah, exactly.
which is effectively saying that then they don't really mean anything in real practical terms. I think it's been interesting to kind of watch the debate play out in the British press, because there's a sense that there's one group which is going to be pro-EU pretty much irrespective of, how things are going with the migration, how the migration crisis is being handled, how foreign policy is being handled, and how the renegotiations go. And then there's this other side, which is of the opposite view, that they don't really care about any of those things. They just want to leave. And given that the referendum might happen as early as June, I don't think there's going to be any time for any kind of meaningful debate around this at all, if that was ever possible.
The problem is, I think we have to have a debate sometime around June if we want to stay in, because I think actually the longer this debate drags on, the more Eurosceptic people are becoming. Because, we're not managing to, this idea of like a reformed member state of the EU is kind of a falsehood. We may have struck sort of some, as you said, symbolic deals, but I wouldn't call what we have come back or what David Cameron's come back with as constituting a reform.
Not really, no.
And the longer this debate drags on, the easier and easier it's going to be for people like Nigel Farage to say, "Well, come on, mate, let's just get out of there."
Well, there's an argument that the reason Cameron wants the debate to be as soon as possible is because he feels exactly as you've just suggested, that the later they leave the actual referendum date, the more likely it is that we'll leave. If the vote was held tomorrow, do you know which way you'd vote?
I mean, I think I'd vote to stay in because what limited understanding I have of economics says that it would be quite sensible to stay in. However, I can understand more than a few of the arguments about leaving, not least of which are things about autonomy over certain laws. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree with our judicial system having to bow down to a separate entity. I can understand if it's something like the UN, but I don't necessarily think, you know, certain European appeals on certain issues is fully fair and respectable to our government.
It's interesting that you'd kind of, as you put it, bow down to the UN, but you wouldn't bow down to the European Court of Justice or the European Court of Human Rights, which is actually outside of the EU. Bearing in mind that actually the UN doesn't have very much formalised legal power, and the EU obviously has a great deal of formalised legal power. What's your kind of reasoning behind that?
I think because with the UN, and again, I'm not an expert on these matters, but if, you know, for the UN to deem something illegal or in, you know, flying in the face of human rights, there has to be quite a substantial and involved debate about it, because you have to bring together delegates from many different countries and they have to agree on, first of all, what's been done wrong and then how it's been done wrong.
It does somewhat depend. I mean, as the Julian Assange case we just discussed, the UN panel is actually composed of just four experts. It's not a particularly representative panel in international terms.
I mean, to a degree, I disagree. That was a work group, but even there, you had a lawyer from the Ukraine involved. You had an Australian who ended up stepping down from the final sort of deliberations, essentially, because, you know, she thought there was a conflict of interest. But I think it's interesting that with the UN you do have the potential for such a wide sort of range of representation, because I think it sort of helps level things out to be more reasonable, or such is the sort of theory and hope. My thoughts are, and they are limited in scope, I just get the impression that the European courts are a bit overpowered in terms of interfering with a country's sovereign judicial system.
But kind of the point of the EU, wouldn't you agree, is that individual nations lose their sovereignty, or at least have to pool it, is the word usually used. So instead of being sovereign from a national perspective, you're sovereign from a federal perspective, I guess you could say.
I mean, I guess that's where my view of the EU slightly, you know, is, I wouldn't say it even differs, I'd say this is quite a sort of common view, but my view of the EU is more that it's a financial sort of institution of which we are a member. That is the way I look at it, and I'm happy for the sort of free trade and stuff like that to stay. I can understand people getting a bit annoyed with things like laws being interfered with, or extraditions being overturned, stuff like that. I can understand that more than I can understand. Because I think symbolically it gets people frustrated with the idea that the laws of their land are not, in some way, not ratified. The idea that Britain's laws are sort of almost a bureaucratic formality to go through because they can always be challenged, which I know is a very overblown melodramatic sort of understanding of things.
There's a kernel of truth there, isn't there?
Yeah, I can see how people sort of feel frustrated with that, because, yeah, you like to imagine that the laws by which you have to live are, you know, sensible and upheld and mean something, I suppose.
To be fair, I think the fact is that all of the various member states have agreed to this process at some point. They've agreed, I mean, Greece is the classic example, is that a lot of people would say Europe has kind of bullied the Greek government, but, and in some ways they have, but at some point the Greek government did say, oh, we will agree to abide by all of your rules so that we can have access to your market and we can have a say of as to how the European rules are made and et cetera, and you can certainly say all of that is true about Britain as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, this is the problem with being a member of anything for a long enough time, is that, you know, the demographics and the constituents of each country changes, as they have here. You know, we've debated this before and decided that we wanted to stay in the EU, or be in the EU rather, in the 70s. It's all sort of, you know, the makeup of the country changes, people's concerns change, the conditions under which you're in the EU change. So I think it's healthy that we have this debate, because I think having a proper debate about things, as opposed to people sort of, I don't want Nigel Farage campaigning on the basis of there not being a referendum, basically, because all he would be doing is stirring up hate.
Do you think actually that, assume the referendum takes place in June, or, you know, just any time this year, and it returns a verdict that says we're going to remain in the EU, do you think this will put the issue to bed, or do you think we'll have another Scottish type situation?
No, I mean, the problem is that this is the big problem, is Nigel Farage's platform is literally just get rid of the immigrants. He's not really talking about a lot more than that. So the EU in that sense has become a scapegoat for the British people, because they...
I disagree with your interpretation of Farage's platform.
Oh, okay. Well, go on. What do you think?
So I think at least if you read somebody like Matt Goodwin and Rob Ford, who produced a book called Revolt on the Right, and more recently Matt Goodwin produced a similar book with Caitlin Milazzo, which is kind of a follow-up to it. But that kind of tracks the whole history of UKIP. And what happened is that UKIP, for a very long time, UKIP started as an academic project launched by a guy... a professor at the London School of Economics, which is a university in London. And eventually it started off as a very fringe, like arch-Tory Eurosceptic group that was interested in the question of Europeans and British sovereignty from a constitutional point of view, which is obviously not very interesting to the majority of people. I think the genius of Farage, if I can use that word, is that he was able to conflate very strongly the idea of the EU and immigration, because people do care about immigration. And he managed to ally it to, you know, the classic tropes of, you know, these undeserving people stealing benefits, which isn't true from a net perspective, certainly.
Not at all. In fact, they put more back into the economy than they take out.
Yeah, because you're unlikely to move to a country if you're from a stable European country, you're unlikely to move to Britain just to gain more benefits, because if you don't have a house and a support network and all of that stuff, you're going to be worse off as a matter of overall, basically.
In my personal experience, and you get this from interviews with migrants coming over, they're desperate to build their own lives, and, you know, they don't necessarily expect anything. Take the Syrian refugees. Now, because of the financial situation in Syria, most of them are actually middle class, so they want to come over here and build a life to which they are or were formerly accustomed. They want to rebuild it when they get over here, so they want to come here, they want to get jobs, they want, you know, to sort their lives out. There are a lot of British people who are very aware of the systems we've got and are very aware of how to exploit them. And I don't necessarily get the impression that migrants are coming over here with any sort of prior knowledge of the intricacies of how to exploit. I'm sure there are some, there are always some, but I don't think they're the majority at all.
So I feel like I'm inching towards a very soft outvote at the moment. I think probably it depends on which article I've read most recently, I think, because there's certainly sometimes where I look at it and think it probably is better overall, but from my point of view, I think there's this argument that's made by Europhiles that says what we should do is stay within the EU and we should reform it from the inside more to our liking. And two things strike me. One, that's not going to happen, because Britain's outside the euro, which is the most important point. And also, Britain has generated such a great degree of ill will over the past few years, especially, but just over the past couple of decades more broadly, that it would be very hard for us to repair our diplomatic standing, and actually get to the stage where we could actually lead reform more so than a country like Germany, which is at the very centre of Europe politically, and legally speaking. And the other thing that strikes me is that I think the EU is just set up very poorly in terms of governance. And these issues are obviously related, but if you look at the way the EU has handled the migration crisis, it's just been complete fucking chaos. I mean, the central event of the migration crisis from a political perspective was, from a governance perspective, I should say, was Angela Merkel saying, Germany will welcome 1 million migrants this year, and that was in 2015. And just the fact that there's, it's just not set up very well from my point of view. You get people doing things like that, and you also get the situation where people in Greece and more recently Portugal are having their budgets vetoed by a seemingly unaccountable and very opaque institution, which is the European, just the EU in general, which is made up of the European Commission, the European Council of Ministers, which is the heads of states and various leaders of the different member states, and then also the European Parliament. And the democratic deficit, I think, is a very serious problem. I know I've sort of elided between the two problems of governance and democratic deficit, but I just think it's very ineffective, and it doesn't really take account of how people feel about their nation state. And you sort of mentioned it earlier in the podcast, is that people do have this sense that they'd rather be governed from a national level as opposed to an international level. And I just don't really see that the EU is ever going to solve that problem, irrespective of whether we stay in or not.
I mean, essentially, in an ideal world, I don't actually think we should be having this referendum, because I think it's that, I know that directly contradicts something I said earlier, but it's part of the same point. I don't think this is actually the right time culturally to be debating this. I think we're going through a movement at the moment in Europe, arguably the rest of the world, where nationalism is becoming a big thing, because we're kind of experiencing the backlash to globalization right now. And there's a lot of scapegoating going on. There's a lot of, I mean, essentially, I don't think people are equipped to vote on this, because a lot of people do kind of just look at the EU and see, migration as a problem, and they think that, all these sort of Polish people and whatever are coming over and nicking our jobs and stuff like that. And that's a very dim and uninformed sort of view of things, and I think that's what far too many people in the UK are sort of basing their decisions upon.
So you said that now is not the right time, but is there any time that you think that people would be well informed enough to actually make a decision like this?
I mean, the thing is that these kind of cultural currents can change so quickly, but they can also sort of linger. I would like to think in 5 years' time that this sort of current of nationalism might have died away a bit.
But couldn't you argue that that in a way is very much loading the vote? You're basically saying I don't want the vote to be right now because I'm not sure it would lead to the result that I want. I mean, it sounds very much like that's what you're
Oh,
saying.
no, not at all. It's no reflection really on whether I think we should be in or out. I just think if we're going to have a proper debate about the EU, it shouldn't all be about sort of these falsehoods of essentially a debate driven in part by xenophobia. I don't think that that's healthy. I don't think it's a productive debate. If we're going to debate about the EU, let's debate it very seriously. Let's not debate it on this sort of scary idea of,
But from a political point of view, you're kind of restricting the remit of democratic discourse. And although
I mean, I have no basis for, I wouldn't want that. I have no basis for wanting this to happen in real life. I just think it's sad that we're debating it at a time when culturally, I don't think we're quite equipped to debate it as a society.
Oh, so you're not really questioning its legitimacy. You're saying from a personal perspective, you don't like the fact that this is how it's
Oh,
panning out.
yeah. I'm not
Okay.
questioning its legitimacy. I just think, as you see with other countries, I think it's Denmark has a sort of very extremist far right political party at the moment, who's gaining a lot of support off the basis of hating Muslims and worrying about the, I think it's the Islamification of Europe and the West. And I think having debates about Europe at times, because I mean there are people now who are starting to equate Europe with Islamification because of the ideas of integration. I don't think that's true at all, and but you know, people are conflating these ideas, and I think that that's a worrying basis on which to decide such an important issue.
Okay, well, I should say before we round this up, because I'm aware Jasmine might be listening back to this and screaming at the podcast, that if he was here, he would be very much defending the idea of Europe and why we should stay in and all the benefits that it has brought us in terms of economic benefits, the reduction of tariffs, the harmonisation of various markets, the fact that you can go over and study in, say, a Dutch university if you're English, and you won't be gouged in terms of university fees. All of that stuff is stuff that he would mention, and
European health insurance, I'm sure, is a lovely little thing that you would say we benefit from.
And I'm sure we, when we next debate this, Jazz will be here and he'll be able to put that argument a bit more robustly. But if you have any thoughts of your own on this, at Right Dishonour on Twitter, or you can contact us via rightdishonourable.com. But next up, we are going to discuss the strange appointment of Matt LeBlanc as the next co-host of Top Gear.
Following last year's quote-unquote fracas between Jeremy Clarkson and Ocean Timon, basically Top Gear, didn't get shut down purposefully. It's sort of continuing, but everybody left.
There's a regime change, I think.
Yeah, it's been a big regime change. And the search sort of was underway for who was going to replace, who, you know, a guy many people see as very charismatic, Jeremy Clarkson.
That is the nicest thing anyone's ever said about Clarkson, I think.
And they came up with Chris Evans, which some people like. Some people like me think is a terrible idea.
I don't know anyone that's really spoken very much in his favour, other than saying that he likes cars a lot.
You know, people who like TFI Fridays are like, oh, Chris Evans can fucking present anything. My argument is just go watch any episode of The One Show that he was presenting and see whether you can stay awake. Anyway, they've decided that they're going to solve the potential problem of him being boring as fuck by inviting friends. Oh God, it's just so stupid. Joey from Friends, Matt LeBlanc, is going to be one of the new presenters. Now, I mean, if we are all honest about it, there is a very cynical and very true reason to why this has happened. Matt LeBlanc is going to be very cheap. He's going to be there for the entire series, and it's not going to cost the BBC a lot of money.
Do you think that's the reason? I just thought they were much cheaper.
Right, I'm just gonna. This is one of my backups. Right, so there's an article about he was talking on the Radio 2 breakfast show or something. He was saying about how weird it was to see himself on the front page of the New York Times. And thanks to Top Gear and the BBC, my day has been ducking paparazzi all day long, and how crazy it was that people actually cared that he was becoming. So now, this just stinks of somebody who has lost all relevance to the public, who can sort of walk around Tesco's and is such old hat. Matt LeBlanc, oh yeah, okay, let him buy a chicken, I don't give a fuck. And now they're like, oh, Matt LeBlanc, you do Top Gear. That's quite interesting.
They must be paying him a couple of million to present Top Gear, surely. I'm sure the previous hosts were.
The thing is, though, think about since Friends, what has he done that's been successful? He tried to do that spin-off Joey, which
sucked.
I mean, it was so bad. It didn't just suck. It sucked balls, anus, fucking gooch, sweat. It was terrible. It was so bad.
I'm not sure they're going to put that quote on the dust jacket, to be honest, John.
He's done this, what is it, episodes thing over here, which...
Episodes is kind of funny.
Apparently it's got better as it goes along. Actually, the first season of it, I remember being received not very well. Apparently subsequent seasons have been quite good.
I'd say it's mildly amusing. It's not a laugh out loud romp, as they would say.
But, you know, it's fair to say he hasn't been in any films or anything. Put it this way. If you had him as... you can imagine him being on something like Celebrity Bake Off or you know, Dancing with the Stars or something like that, because
Yeah.
he's in that kind of like, you know, CD grade celebrity thing now, so he is going to come quite cheap. And also, just I really worry about how cringing, because the guy was great on Friends. I don't think anybody can dispute that. But if you've seen any interviews with Matt LeBlanc, he's not the most charismatic or interesting of people. So you've got like one show granddad versus, I don't know, a cardboard cutout of a Friends character, and the Stig will be thrown in, and somehow this is expected to work.
So the way I actually perceive this, and I thought it was the more obvious thing, is that Top Gear is a global brand. It's actually the most successful show the BBC, I think, has ever produced. Certainly the one that makes it the most money, because the BBC has a commercial arm in addition to its public service duties. And I saw this as a way of tapping into the American market and maybe making a big push. To spread Top Gear around America. I don't know how well it is spread around America at this
Wait, do
stage.
people in America really give a fuck about Matt LeBlanc? Like,
I
if
think you'd be
I'm
surprised. I think Americans give far more of a fuck about Matt
really,
LeBlanc than.
if you're an American, do you think you're gonna like? If you're not watching Top Gear up until this point, you say, "Oh, fucking petrol heads, I'm so not interested." You're gonna go, "Oh, the guy from Friends is in it though, so I'm gonna start watching it
You might
now."
give it a go, and obviously it's just got the BBC a ton of free publicity on the front page of the New York Times, so it's obviously done something in that vein already.
Yeah, but well, I mean, I was actually surprised by the fact that I haven't seen more articles saying what a fucking terrible idea this is, because I really don't think this is going to go well personally. I think this was a really bad choice.
Who would you have to, who would, I mean, do you actually watch Top Gear, or did you watch Top Gear in
Yeah,
its
no, I
heyday?
did used to watch it. I actually, there were rumors going around that the woman from Bake Off with the glasses.
I feel you're not asking the right person to pick out the woman from Bake Off.
I know, but she's like a female lesbian comedian.
A female woman? Jeez.
Yeah, female woman.
A female
And
lesbian,
she's
no
gone.
less.
I'll look it up on the internet for a second. But
Is it
yeah, she was good. She
something
was heavily.
Perkins? Is that.
There we go, Suzanne
There you
Perkins.
go.
She was heavily rumored to be taking over the duties of coasting, and I ho coasting ho God.
That's a Freudian slip right there.
Freudian slip. She was r heavily rumored to be taking over. I thought that would have been great, because I thought it would have, you know, shaken up the dynamic. Because let's remember, Richard Hammond, before he came onto the show, wasn't like a big household name. The reason they picked him to do Top Gear was because he'd had such a successful run with Brainiac Science Abuse.
Is that the reason? I thought Brainiac came after Top Gear.
No, it didn't. Brainiac was before Top Gear, because I remembered sort of sequentially. You're going to look this up now and find out that I'm wrong. But okay, my memory of it was very much that I'd seen him on Brainiac first, and then when I saw him on Top Gear, I was like, ah.
See, Hammond used to be a radio host for like local radio, and I think he did some car related programs as part of that before he was recruited to Top Gear. I don't know the chronology of like Brainiac, whether it came for or after Top Gear, but yeah, I mean him and James May were not household names. It was really Jeremy Clarkson when he decided to revive the Top Gear brand with his school friend who produced the show and it has moved with them to Amazon as well, whose name escapes me. He'd been on the previous iteration of Top Gear, and he was also a well-known public figure, I suppose. I mean, the value of Clarkson as a brand, I was reading the other day that apparently he accounted for like more than half of the page hits on the Times website at one stage or another. I don't know if that's still true, but he's a big deal actually.
But I think people, this is one of the things people get wrong about Top Gear though, is, you know, it's very funny to see the sort of pseudo-racist, crazy, you know, the bit where he sort of said the N-word on air and stuff like that. It's
Or didn't really say nigger on air.
I mean, he so did though. If you listen back to that tape, he clearly says nigger under his breath.
He sort of says, yeah.
Somebody has played with that in post to make it sound less bad than it was.
Well,
He definitely.
irrespective, I'm sure Clarkson at some point has said nigger. He's certainly said everything else, every other racial epithet,
Yeah,
so.
he's anyway, my point being that people actually, I think, concentrate on him a bit too much. I think what made Top Gear wasn't so much him. I think it was the nice little dynamic they got going. I do actually think if you took Richard Hammond and James May out of the picture, it wouldn't have been a very good show. I think they really did make it as like a team.
I agree, although there is the first series of Top Gear post reboot, post the 2002 reboot, was actually didn't actually have James May on, I don't think. Like
All right.
it was either May or Hammond was missing, and they only came in the second series. So I guess you could go back and actually watch that show and see if that is true. But yeah, from my point of view, the reason that I watched it when I did watch it was because of the camaraderie between the three of them, I
Yeah,
think.
and I think that's totally true. How many Captain Slow jokes would have not existed had it not been for James May? And Hammond, there was a constant thing around his size and the fact that he was the youngest of them by far, so he was a bit more in touch than the other two.
Not saying very much.
No, it's not saying very much at all, but he definitely was. And he was also actually secretly, I think, a bit of a left-wing balance for the other two,
He was
because.
the guy. He very much played the Jazza role in our podcast, in that you say something offensive and then Jazza goes, "Oh,
Yeah,
that's offensive."
exactly. He did used to do that sort of he because apparently he's I don't this it could be bollocks, but apparently he's quite a nice guy in real life. Anyway, my point being,
I like that you said that as though you were going to say something really rude about him, and then you're like,
All right.
apparently, allegedly, I've just heard a rumor. Apparently, he's a very nice guy in
The thing
real
is,
life.
what is Matt LeBlanc going to bring to like a team dynamic? He's just like every week you're just is he going to be crying about the fact, I'm just so happy to be back on TV. I'll do anything, make me drive into a pile of manure. Just I'm getting paid again, I can eat.
It's also hard to see that, like, I think the reason the camaraderie worked between Hammond May and Clarkson was that they all came from the same like cultural milieu of like middle class, grew up in the were born in the 60s or whatever, or like late 50s, and kind of grew up like at the same period, had all the same reference points and all the same cultural touchstones. Like they'd reference things like Z Cars, which was a TV show back in the 80s or whenever, and that for me is sort of the reason why it worked, is it was a kind of slightly archaic bit of British culture, and they all knew that they were a little bit backward and they didn't really fit in with the modern media landscape all that well, and I just can't really see that being replicated with Chris Evans for a start, but also Matt LeBlanc.
Yeah, I mean, some people have said that it's interesting because it could end up being like a sort of Joey and Chandler sort of dynamic going on between Matt LeBlanc and Chris Evans. And I'm sure actually that's what they're going to maybe try and hint at. The problem is, though, that Matt LeBlanc isn't playing Joey. Like, he's not going to appear on Top Gear as Joey. He's going to appear. I mean, I'd love actually to see Joey on Top Gear. I think that'd be fucking amazing. But he's gonna appear as the far less interesting, oddly enough, far less intelligent Matt LeBlanc. And that's just not gonna go well. It's gonna be too far south of, entertaining. It's gonna.
I have to say though, I wasn't planning on watching the new episode of the new series of
Ah,
Top
but this
Gear.
has done it for you.
I'll probably watch at least the first episode just to see like what the fuck's going on,
Is that
really.
like a rubbernecking thing, though? If you just want to check whether it was a horrific enough car crash,
Yeah,
you want to
basically.
see
Yeah,
whether
I
the
mean,
bodies are sort of mangled in the front,
you
very
know,
dangerous.
I'm going to hold off judgment. It might turn out really well. Maybe the people who have put together this presenting team have done their homework and they've decided that it works. You
Here's an
know,
interesting way of looking at this, right? So obviously we know that the old Top Gear team have got a new show on Amazon that's coming out at some point this year. I don't think it's been announced when, but we know that it's coming. They've been filming it. It's going to be released on Amazon Prime streaming service.
Yeah, that's right.
Are any of them worried by this announcement?
I shouldn't think so. I think the decision to go with Amazon was probably poor from an audience, kind of amassing perspective. I don't think the, I think the show will struggle to gain the widespread audience it had that Top Gear had, because a lot of people just don't have Amazon Prime. It's very much seen as the inferior sibling to Netflix.
You say this, so just as a counterpoint to that, though, they have had some very good and notable successes in the past 18 months with programming, though, because I would have agreed with you, but they've had things like Transparent won a whole bunch of Emmys, and that's exclusively on Amazon. They've got other shows like Mr. Robot is doing very well. You can only get that over here on Amazon. So they are increasingly getting some very good exclusive programming.
And I think actually the I'm just trying to think, I'm just trying to work out how many subscribers Amazon Prime actually has.
Netflix had a fucking terrible reason for not picking up this sort of proposed, new series with Clarkson
What was
and
their
Hamilton.
reasoning?
So they said, because obviously they keep track of all their figures of what people watch. They said not enough people watched Top Gear on their streaming services to justify the amount of money that sort of Clarkson and Hammond and May's team came and said we can make a program for. I think this is, I can't believe how much oversight comes into that equation because, like, be real. I mean, I enjoy Top Gear. I will watch it if it's on the BBC. I will watch a rerun of it if it's on the BBC. I might even occasionally go as far as watching it on iPlayer if I've missed it. Am I going to go back and watch previous series? Fuck no. I'm not going to sit on
Yeah, that's
Netflix
true.
streaming, a couple of year old episodes of. There are better things to watch by far. I'm not going on Netflix to watch that.
See, I've got some stats here that apparently I'm not sure where these are from, but Amazon Prime has 10 million subscribers and Netflix has 30 million. These might be slightly
Wow.
out of date.
Is that in the UK alone?
I'm not 100% sure. But the thing is, like, Amazon Prime is a bit complicated to analyze because some people will have Amazon Prime for the delivery service, and the fact that it's a package deal kind of changes the whole dynamic
Yeah,
there.
that's
I
true.
really should have done this research before we actually started this segment, but classic right dishonorable. Do you think that I mean, are you going to watch the new episode of Top Gear, and are you going to watch the new series of whatever Clarkson comes out with?
Oh God. I will watch the new series that Clarkson comes out with, I think, just because I'm interested to see. When you take away the limitations that the BBC, because he's spoken quite aggressively when he's been drunk and filmed on camera phones. He said this thing at this benefit shortly after the whole fracker thing broke, and he said, "Oh, Top Gear used to be a decent show. They've fucked it now. The producers at the BBC, they've fucked it," and all of this kind of stuff. I thought, well, that's interesting that you think that, because what are they sort of saying no to? What suggestions are you coming up with that you want to do that they won't let you do? So I'm interested to see what happens when you sort of let him and May and Hammond loose, whether there's sort of some really off-the-wall shit that they wanted to do for years that they haven't been able to do. I'm less bothered about seeing the new Top Gear on BBC, to be honest, mostly because I really struggle to understand Chris Evans' appeal to, and I mean I should be championing him, right? Because he's a ginger who's also losing his hair with ridiculous glasses, and he has had several dubious body shapes through his life.
He's basically you, but richer and more successful.
I'd love to think that he's me, but more boring, though.
I mean, I think that's probably true. I'm
He's
not sure
just.
how much of a benchmark that is for you to have to jump over, though.
It's just like even if you watch TF, it's like TFI Friday is good. I will, the revival series they did recently, I caught an episode of it and I thought, actually, I can understand why people liked this. But a lot of the genius of TFI Friday is like all the guest people you have coming in doing mad shit. It's not, I would argue it's not so much him.
I should say I've just sort of been looking at figures in the backgrounds. Those stats I'd said before about 30 million subscribers for Netflix and 10 million for Amazon are actually from sort of mid 2013, so they're well out of date at this point, but I suspect there's still a difference in the difference in degree is still quite similar. I suspect Netflix still have more subscribers than Amazon.
I should. I think we should add in a jazzer point.
Okay, go on
So,
then. That
of course.
Clarkson's offensive.
Well, no. It's terrible that the BBC have gone with Matt LeBlanc because he's white.
He's American though, and that name is clearly French,
Well,
so
that actually,
diversity, you know.
to be fair, there are some very good. I mean, I thought I actually Sue Perkins would have been a good idea because she's a woman, and she's apparently a very good driver. But actually,
Is being a good driver a necessary
no.
quality for a Top Gear host?
Yeah, that's true. One of the things I just thought of was Idris Elba actually did a couple of programs for the BBC about driving. So he's clearly a petrol head. Why did nobody ask him?
I think we need to broaden our diversity suggestions from Idris Elba. He appears to be being suggested from ev for
Yes.
every role these days.
He's
I'm not sure he has the time.
becoming our token go-to black guy for everything, isn't he?
Yeah.
Want diversity? Just add in Idris Elba.
But would Top Gear have been improved with more diversity? I mean, would anything really is the question.
Well, I think what female comedians are doing these days is quite subversive and fresh. So I would have thought from that point of view, Sue Perkins would have worked very well. Would somebody like actually, I personality wise, would Idris Elba have really added anything? I'm not so sure because yeah, all they is no, I, like all they.
I'm just enjoying that you're now considering Idris Elba as a serious contender.
Well, I struggle to think of any other like really interesting petrol head, famous black people we have from the. I suppose it doesn't have to be from the UK, does it? We've got Matt LeBlanc.
This is true. The doors are wide open now.
Who's falling flat on their ass in America? Invite Bill Cosby. That'd be a great idea.
Wow, and I think on that suggestion, it's probably time to wrap this up. If you have any suggestions of your own,
Gonna put a star in the recently
stop it,
repossessed
stop it,
car.
stop it, stop it. If you have any
Have the
suggestions,
strength before you go out on the track.
if you have any suggestions of your own, send them in at Write to Sonar. Or at www.writedishonorable.com. And if you have anything that you want to tweet to me or John, I can be found at JDE Nichols on Twitter. John, where can you be found?
I can be found at Donkey OK.
And we're all very upset about that to this day. But we've been the Right Dishonourable, and this podcast has already gone on a very long time. So I probably won't edit it down. I'm going to be realistic about it. But if you made it this far, congratulations. We will see you next week.
See ya, peeps.
So, what order do you want to do these in?
I suppose the most serious one is the oh, actually, I don't know. The most boring one is probably the EU thing.
Okay, that's true. Do you want to start with Assange then?
Yeah, because then it's like a shit sandwich, isn't it?
Right.